Well, it is 9 o'clock, so I think we're going to get started, considering we're doing a lesson and a half today, and when I timed it, I pretty much went right up to that time limit. All right, so like I said, we're going to do the second half of lesson 11, so we'll be starting on page 4 of those lesson notes, and then we will finish off with lesson 13. Hopefully we'll make it all the way through, but if not, we'll finish 13 next week with 14. We're looking at monasticism. I considered skipping it for a split second, but it will come up later in church history, so I think it's important to cover it now. Not all Christians who received the new peace Constantine brought them with joy. There were some who lamented what they saw as a low level to which the Christian life had descended. The narrow gate Jesus spoke of had become so wide that countless multitudes were rushing through it, many seeming only to do so in the pursuit of privilege and position, without caring to understand too deeply the meaning of Christian baptism and life under the cross. Bishops competed for prestigious positions. The rich and powerful seemed to dominate the life of the church. The tares were growing so rapidly, it seemed that they would soon choke out the wheat. For almost 300 years, the church had lived under the constant threat of persecution. All Christians accepted the possibility that someday they might be taken before the Roman authorities and given the choice of apostasy or death. During the prolonged periods of peace in the second and third centuries, there were those who forgot this possibility of persecution, and when it did arrive, they were too weak to withstand the pressure. This convinced many that the security and comfortable living in times of peace were the greatest enemies of the faith, and these enemies were stronger and stronger when there was peace. Now, when the peace of the church seemed assured, many saw that assurance as nothing more than the snare of Satan. How is a true Christian to live in such circumstances? When the church joins the powers of the world, when luxury and ostentation take hold of Christian altars, when the whole of society is intent on turning the narrow path into a wide lane, how is one to resist the enormous temptations of the times? Many found the answer in living a monastic life, to flee from society, to leave behind everything, to dominate the body and its passions, which gave way to temptation. At the very time churches were being flooded by thousands demanding baptism, there was an equal exit of thousands who sought blessedness in seclusion. Even before Constantine's time, there were Christians who, for various reasons, felt called to a lifestyle. And as we've already mentioned, widows and virgins, those were women who chose not to marry or to remarry so they could devote all of their time and energies to the work of the church. Origen followed the Platonic ideal and made arrangements to live at a mere survival level and led a life of extreme asceticism. And although the Gnostics had been rejected from the church, its influence could still be felt in the widely held notion that there was a fundamental opposition between the body and the soul. A number of outside influences also played a part in the development of the Christian monastic movement. Several schools of philosophy held that the body was a prison of the soul, and that the soul could not be truly free unless it overcame the limitations of the body. Stoic doctrine was also widespread at the time and held that the passions of the body are the enemy of true wisdom. Several religions in the Mediterranean basin included sacred virgins, celibate priests, eunuchs, and others whose lifestyle seemed to set them apart for service to their God. This sense of the body, and particularly sexual relations, was somehow evil or unworthy of those devoted to holiness, became such a widespread problem that there was an attempt to curb this extreme practice at the Council of Nicaea, ordering that any among the clergy that castrated themselves be deposed, and no one who had done such a thing would be admitted into the clergy. Although there were early monastics throughout the Roman Empire, it was the Egyptian desert that provided the most fertile soil for the growth of monasticism. The word monk is derived from the Greek word monachos, which means solitary. One of the driving motivations for the early monks was a search for solitude. For these people, the desert was attractive, not because of its hardship, but because of its inaccessibility. What they were seeking was not the burning sands, but rather an oasis, a secluded valley, or a cemetery where they would not be disturbed by others. It is impossible to know who the first monk or nun of the desert was. The two names usually given are Paul and Anthony, and they owe their fame to the great Christian writers Jerome and Athanasius, who wrote about them, each claiming his guy was the first founder of Egyptian monasticism. Jerome's life of Paul is very brief and probably entirely legend, but at the center, the story is likely true. Toward the middle of the 3rd century, fleeing persecution, a man named Paul went to the desert, where he found an abandoned hiding place once used by counterfeiters. There he spent the rest of his life in prayer and a diet of mostly dates. According to Jerome, Paul lived in such conditions for almost a century, while his only visitors being beasts of the desert and an elderly monk named Anthony. According to Athanasius, Anthony was born in a small village on the shore of the Nile, a son of wealthy parents. He was likely a Copt, a descendant of the ancient Egyptians who now suffered oppression and discrimination from both Greeks and Romans. When Anthony's parents died, they left enough wealth for him and his sister to live a comfortable life. One day in a church, Anthony read Jesus' words in Matthew 19:21. If you would be perfect, go sell what you possess and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. In response to these words, Anthony sold all of his property and gave the proceeds to the poor, leaving only a portion for the care of his sister. Later, he was moved by the words of Jesus in Matthew 6:34, "Do not be anxious about tomorrow," and he disposed of even the small fund he had kept for his sister, placed her under the care of the virgins of the church, and left for the desert. Anthony spent time for a while learning from other monks in the desert until he eventually moved on and lived in a tomb in an abandoned cemetery. It was at this time, according to Athanasius, that Anthony began having visions of demons that accosted him continuously. When he was 35, Anthony had a vision in which God told him not to fear, for he could always count on the divine. It was then that Anthony moved even further into the desert and found an abandoned fort to make his residence. The demons followed him there, but Anthony was now convinced that he had God's help, and struggle with the demons became more bearable. Unfortunately for Anthony, it was not only the demons who followed him to his monastic pursuit, but other monks who desired to learn from him the discipline of quiet prayer and contemplation. He was also pursued by the curious and ailing, as he had garnered a reputation as a worker of miracles. No matter how far into the desert he retreated, someone always managed to find him. Eventually, he gave up the struggle and agreed to live near a group of disciples. But he gave them the condition that they could not visit him too often. In exchange, Anthony would occasionally come and talk to them about monastic discipline, the love of God, and prayerful contemplation. On 2 occasions, Anthony did visit Alexandria. The first was during the persecution of Diocletian, and Anthony and several disciples came and offered themselves up for martyrdom. However, the prefect decided that such disheveled characters were not worth his attention, so they had to be content with offering up words of encouragement to others. Anthony's second visit to Alexandria took place years later during the Arian controversy. The Arians were claiming that Anthony had taken their side, and he decided that the only way to undo such false rumors was to appear in person before the bishops of Alexandria. According to Athanasius, the elderly hermit spoke in Coptic, since he did not know Greek and was likely illiterate, but he spoke with such wisdom and conviction that he confounded the Arians. Towards the end of his life, Anthony had 2 younger monks living with him and caring for him. He died in 356 after instructing his 2 disciples to keep the place of his burial secret and to send his cloak, his only possession, to the bishop Athanasius. Both Paul and Anthony had gone to the desert before the time of Constantine, but when Constantine came to power, the life of these hermits in the desert became much more popular. Travelers in the region declared that the desert was more populated than the cities, and others speak of 20,000 women and 10,000 men leading the monastic life in a single area in Egypt. Similar numbers are given for the arid regions of Cappadocia, in what is now Turkey, where monks dug caves in the soft stone of the area. Although these figures are likely exaggerated, one thing is certain, that those who fled society for the life of a hermit were vast in number. Their lives are very simple. Some planted gardens, but most of them earned a living by weaving baskets and mats that they traded for food and oil. Their diet consisted mostly of bread with the occasional fruit or vegetable. Their only belongings were the clothes on their backs and a mat to sleep on. Most of them frowned on the owning of books, which they believed led to pride. They taught each other by heart entire books of the Bible. The growing number of people withdrawing to the desert and the desire for most of them to learn from an experienced teacher gave rise to a new form of monastic life. Increasingly, solitary monastic life gave way to community monastic life. This form of monastic life is called cenobitic, a name derived from 2 Greek words meaning communal life. The cenobitic monasticism was born out of a natural tendency of monastics to gather around a particularly saintly leader and out of the commandment to love one another, which is kind of hard to do when you're living a completely solitary life. Although not the founder of communal monasticism, Pacomius deserves credit as the organizer who contributed to the development of this type of monasticism. He was born around 286 to pagan parents. Pacomius seems to have known little of Christianity until he was taken from his home and forced to join the army. A group of Christians came alongside him and his companions to comfort them in their unfortunate lot. Pacomius was so impressed by this act of love that he vowed that if he was ever able to leave the military, he too would devote himself to the service of others. When he was unexpectedly allowed to leave the service, he sought out a Christian teacher to instruct him in the Christian faith and to baptize him. A while later, he withdrew into the desert and asked an elderly monk to be his teacher. Eventually, his brother John joined him, and the two brothers devoted themselves to prayer and contemplation. Pacomius constantly asked God to show him how he can serve better. He had a vision of an angel who instructed him to serve mankind. Now, at first, he rejected this since his desire was to serve God and not man. The message was repeated, and he changed direction, and with his brother's help, they built a large enclosure, sufficient for a number of monks, and recruited what would be the first members of the community. Now, his first attempt at community life ended when discipline broke down, and Pacomius expelled all the newly recruited monks. Trying again, he became even more rigorous, demanding that anyone who wished to join must give up all their goods and promise absolute obedience to their superiors. All would work with their hands, and no one would consider any task unworthy. This time, Pacomius was successful, and his sister founded similar communities for women. The daily life of a Pacomian monk included both work and devotion, with Pacomius himself always taking on the most humble tasks. For devotional life, those communities were encouraged to pray without ceasing. While they worked, they sang psalms, recited scripture passages, and prayed, sometimes silently and sometimes out loud. Twice a day, they had common prayers. In the morning, they would gather and pray and hear the reading of scriptures, and in the evening, they did the same. Although they lived in poverty, Pacomius did not insist on extreme poverty, like some of the monks lived in. At meals, there was bread, fruit, vegetables, and fish, which was the only meat that they would eat. What the monks produced, they sold in the marketplace, not only so that they could buy food and other necessities, but also that they could give to the poor and to sojourners. Twice a year, all Pacomian monks gathered for prayer and worship to deal with any issues necessary to maintain proper order of the communities. In the women's communities, life was structured the same. Although the roots of monasticism are not found entirely in Egypt, it is where the movement gained the most momentum in the 4th century. From Syria, Asia Minor, Italy, and Mesopotamia, people flocked to the land of the Nile, and on their return, they would spread stories of the legends of Paul, Anthony, Pacomius, and countless others. Those who most contributed to the spread of the monastic ideal were not the monks who copied the ways of the Egyptian desert, but rather a number of bishops and scholars who saw the value in a monastic witness for the daily life of the church. Athanasius, beside writing the life of St. Anthony, repeatedly visited the monks in the desert, and when he was persecuted by the imperial authority, he found refuge among them. Although Athanasius himself was not a monk, but a bishop, he sought to organize his life to reflect the monastic ideals of discipline. When exiled in the West, he made known to the Latin-speaking church what was taking place in the Egyptian desert. Jerome, who wrote the life of Paul the Hermit and translated Pacomius's rule into Latin, became a monk himself, although an unusually scholarly one. Basil of Caesarea found time in the midst of theological debates to organize monasteries where time was given to both devotion and care of the needy. Even Augustine lived the life of a monk for a while until he was forced to take a more active role in the church. Already in these early stages of the monastic movement, it was clear that it had the ability to adapt and evolve in various directions. From the solitude of the early monks, it evolved into large communities, some with hundreds of members. A movement that first shunned books and learning soon enrolled scholars such as Jerome, Augustine, and Basil, three guys that we will talk about next semester. Originally a lay movement that tended to reject much of the life of the church, it was soon embraced by bishops and eventually set the standard for the ideal bishop. This adaptability would continue through the centuries. In all of this, there was a common thread, the conviction that the ideal Christian life was one of personal poverty and sharing of goods. The earlier practice of the Christian communities in general, sharing of goods among members, now became a hallmark of monasticism, something expected of monks and nuns, but not really of the rest of the church. Now that most of the population had become Christian, Most were excused from such sharing, while monastics continued that earlier tradition. This led to a distinction between two levels of Christianity that would mark most of the history of the church, a distinction reinforced by vows of celibacy and obedience that only monastics took. Now we're going to move on to lesson 13.
Question. Did the monastics see themselves still under the church's authority?
I would think so, even though they didn't have much contact with the rest of the church.
Yeah, because it sounds like Anthony, he dies before the Council of Constantine.
Before Nicaea. Yeah, he died before the Council of Nicaea, yeah. Well, he died in 356. Nicaea was in 325, but he didn't go to Nicaea. He went to Alexandria at the beginning of the controversy.
Yeah, it's just, I wonder structurally if the monks or monasticism, you know, eventually the Catholics still have societies, and those are potentially the historical ancestors of these monks. I just wonder, they break away, but they don't necessarily see themselves as separate from, so they must still be operating somewhat under that, whatever existed structurally in the
right.